Friends, there are many people all over the world, people who have not known Krishnaji personally, who, as Edna said, feel a deep sense of gratitude to Krishnamurti, called Krishnaji, for they have felt that reading his books, or if they were so fortunate, listening to his talks, was like being given new light. It was not that Krishnaji spoke of things which had never been spoken before. The wisdom is perennial, the ancient ever new wisdom. But from everyone who has experienced the truth, the wisdom comes in with a freshness, a newness, which gives an impression that it has never been spoken of earlier. The ancient Indians described the immortals in a symbolic way. They said the feet of the immortals do not touch the earth. Their eyes never blink. They never cast a shadow. And there are many tales told about the immortals appearing among the mortals, and the perceptive among the mortals know that there is a visitor, because these signs are there. Those who never touch the earth with their feet are those in whom there is no worldliness, who are not attached to passing things, who have a perspective which is vast and which shows against that background what things really are. And eyes which never blink speak about a consciousness which is always awake, not in a state of inattention, negligence, forgetful, spiritual, and the immortals do not cast a shadow as ordinary men do, and women too, because they are free of egoism. The greatest shadow that we all cast Wherever we go is the shadow of the ego within, the personality, which can be big, casting a very dark shadow, or perhaps less dark, but all the same, wherever the personality is at work, a shadow is cast. This description of the immortals, in a way, describes Krishnaji. I am not suggesting that he was immortal. Obviously, his body came to an end like that of everyone else. But as the spirit recognizes its own nature, it naturally becomes part of the immortal life which is everywhere. And the beauty of Krishnamurti's life was this, that he was truly innocent, very shy from the ordinary point of view, because there was no ego, so far as I could see, wishing to project itself anywhere. When Krishnamurti entered a room, one was hardly aware that he came in. It was not only physically a quiet entrance, but there was some other kind of quietness in that person, in that mind, which brought its own atmosphere into the room. We think of those words in Light on the Path about seeking power. The only power which is worth seeking is the power to appear as nothing before others. And in Krishnaji, one saw that kind of nothingness, and that was part of his innocence. It's difficult to describe that innocence. It consisted partly of caring so little about the passing things, as we mentioned, seeing no value in the things that most people prize, for the consciousness was so much with in another world of reality, of truth. I'm not using the word reality in the sense that he used it, that these things were meaningless to him. For example, money. It was, if you give money to a child, it doesn't mean a thing to that child. May like to play with it. There are children who like to receive coins. If you are spoilt enough to realize that they can go and buy something with the money, but they are not aware of, they do not set a value on money. And it was impossible to convey to Krishnaji a sense of what money meant, or property, or possessions. He merely repeated what other people said with regard to these things. If he wanted to buy some material to make the kind of tunic we call a kurta, and somebody brought the material, and another person said, Krishnaji, we couldn't buy that. It's too costly. He would say, yes, it's too costly. We can't buy that. We don't have enough money. But if somebody else came along and said, of course we can buy it. If you need the kurtas, we'll buy that. He'd say, yes, we can buy it. But he had no idea what it really meant. And it was not a pretense, a pose, but the mind itself seemed to be of a different nature. He couldn't grasp this kind of value. He liked nice material. He liked excellence in everything. And therefore he could appreciate the texture of the material. But whether it cost too much or too little was absolutely beyond his comprehension. Just as it would be beyond the comprehension of a 4-year-old. And so it was with regard to many other things which absorb us. Perhaps it was all Greek and Latin, so to speak, to him. Properties, documents, legal agreements, rules. He couldn't grasp what it was all about. He just followed whatever people told him. And I think anyone whom he trusted could have made him sign anything, because he didn't understand what he was signing. He merely trusted. In that way, he was like a child. And there was great beauty in that. He was not stupid. He was extraordinarily intelligent, very wise. But he did not belong to this world. His feet did not rest upon the earth. And often the consciousness was in another world, which made him look radiant. There was some kind of a light, a beauty, which attracted many people because they could see this. And this is what they say about the immortals. They cast no shadow because they were transparent. The light poured through them. And Krishnaji also had no comprehension about family relationships, blood relationships. Perhaps if you explain to him that A is the brother or sister of B, he could grasp it. But if you went a little further and spoke about a slightly more complicated relationship, he couldn't take it in. I think it was because for him there was nothing but that sense of equality which abolished all blood relationships. In fact, it was very beautiful to see the great respect with which he would greet, approach, converse with those whom other people regarded as unimportant or belonging to a lower category, as servant, and sometimes a foolish or an ignorant person. He would give the same kind of affection to everybody. And he was a very loving child. You know, you can see a small child meeting another child, and they don't feel any difference of color, of social status, of economic position. The other child is only another child. And Krishnaji's meetings with people were generally like that, as innocent as that of a child, with no prejudices in the mind. People spoke about Krishnaji's likes and dislikes, but personally I believe that they did not exist. I am not trying to idealize him, but having watched him at close quarters, I feel these so-called likes and dislikes were merely had something to do with his extreme sensitivity. He was a very sensitive person physically and in every other way, perhaps because of living in the other world, a purer world, of the kind of meditation he describes in his notebooks and the other of his writings, because of his sense of harmony with nature and with living things. Whatever the reason may be, perhaps he was more comfortable, felt relaxed with certain types of vibrations, with people who brought with them with certain vibrations than he did with certain others, which didn't mean that he had prejudices or that he didn't have the same respect or affection. So this kind of relationship, inner relationship he had, also reminded one of the child nature, in the sense in which Jesus spoke about being a little child. In the voice of the silence also, one is told that it is necessary to regain the child state, which is not a form of immaturity, but of innocence, of purity, of freedom from prejudices, and so on. And because he had this openness towards all people, he also had immense patience. I think patience is the characteristic of spiritually developed people. If we read the Mahatma letters, one of the most striking things about them is the great patience with which they answered and explained. And Krishnaji had that kind of patience at discussions, in private conversations, when questions were put during after his talks. Sometimes other people would feel irritated by the questioner and think, what a stupid question to ask. But one realized that if a thought like that arose, then there was some kind of a stupidity or obtuseness in oneself. Because Krishnaji would most often take up the question very, very patiently, gently, repeat what he had to say, explain further, explain the things which he had spoken about many, many times over, and yet, being wise, he never tried to persuade anybody into accepting any form of opinion. Again, I think of our theosophical literature and the many statements which have come from the Mahatmas, saying they never impose their will on anybody. They don't try to model other people. Because what the wise seek is to use Krishnaji's own phrase to awaken the intelligence, the spiritual intelligence in people, which we may also call spiritual discernment, discrimination. And persuading people, imposing ideas on them, inducing them into some form of belief, making them obey, and so on, does not encourage people to awaken their own intelligence. On the other hand, it suppresses the intelligence. They do not then put energy into inquiring, exploring, looking at the question from many different angles, perhaps being silent and allowing the subtler aspects of the problem to reveal themselves. All that is necessary for the quality of the mind to change, for the intelligence to develop. So, he never told people, even those who are close to him, do this, don't do that. When he considered something important, for instance, if somebody felt hurt, cried, or made a scene or something, and if he cared, he would go into the whole situation, into the problem, discuss it from many different points of view, perhaps go round and round it numerous times, trying to help the person to understand the situation for himself or herself and come out of his own problem inside. He would help the person to realize the problem is inside and not outside. And all this required great patience. There are occasions, more than one occasion, when he has I had the good fortune to talk over certain things with him. And generally his attitude was that we may discuss things together, but do what you think is right. And that is very important. To be true to oneself, to do what is right, not thoughtlessly, not emotionally reacting to things, but after thoughtfully going into it, considering things from an impersonal point of view, looking at the different aspects in an objective kind of a way, then doing what seems right. But that rightness has to be spontaneous. It's not a matter of weighing all the pros and cons and sort of coming to an intellectual or mental conclusion about what is the right thing to do. It happened the year before he died, 1985. He was in Varanasi, and there was need to find somebody to look after the educational center there. And at the Theosophical Society, in fact, where he had come for a visit, the Indian section headquarters, he met Professor Krishna, who had had some discussions with him a number of years earlier. Professor Krishna was then professor of physics and head of the Department of Physics in the University of Banaras. Krishnaji asked him, "Will you come and take charge of the education center?" Not immediately, I am not repeating the whole conversation. And I remember Krishna thought about it and he said, "I will have to consider it. My children are yet young. I will have to provide for them," and so on and so forth. And Krishnaji's answer was, "All that may be true. We may have to look into that. But what is it that your heart tells you first? Because what comes from deep within you? Yes or no? That is what you have to consider." So, although Krishnaji discussed with people many things, their fears, their loneliness, you know, the innumerable problems of the human mind. If you read the commentaries on living and such books, you will find in abbreviated form the conversations, how he try to lead people to understand themselves and their own situations. Ultimately, he left it to each person to find out what is right and to act according to what he perceived as right. Maybe the person makes a mistake, but still, it's important to be true to oneself. And so, he was not a person who tried to make people believe in him, in what he said, or encourage belief in any form. And I feel again, this is according to the basic theosophical ideas. If you go to the Mahatma letters, I think it is in the famous letter 10, or maybe in letter 8, I don't remember which. The Mahatma says that people have always wanted crutches, but they want to make people rely on themselves, on their own great spiritual nature, to find it, to discover it, and to act according to it, not according to what somebody else says. So they too have sought to make people free of dependence. In another letter, printed in the Letters from the Masters of the Wisdom, you find again a statement against abject dependence on God or on anything else. So, it was for this reason that Krishnaji would not accept what people usually think of as the guru, that is, the person who instructs and whom you obey or believe, conform to or imitate. That was the last thing he wanted. In his talks, he often used to say, "Don't be influenced by me." And that influence was very strong, because when he spoke, there was such a strong atmosphere, some kind of a great influence seemed to pervade the audience. One remarkable fact that everybody noticed was that this great crowd of people, sometimes 4,000, 5,000 people gathered there, sitting there for an hour or an hour and a half in advance in order to have good places, would be chattering, meeting old friends. Some of them had been coming to the talks for years, and about 5 minutes before Krishnaji came, you could watch. People were not looking at their watches. They were chattering, and all of a sudden, everybody would become quiet, because it seemed as if there was some other influence which came like a shower upon the place, and it quietened their minds. So the influence was very strong. And yet Krishnaji would say, "Don't be influenced by me. Think this out for yourself. Go into it." And he spoke of many things which appear to some people to be abstruse, too deep to understand, complicated. There are people who say he was intellectual, it's hard to understand him. Yet, if you take the fundamental things that he spoke about, even a child can understand. For example, and I shall give only one example, he said, "Don't compare." If the mind doesn't compare, it becomes a different mind. The mind which compares thinks that there is a model and one has to evaluate people according to that model. The mind which compares is the one which becomes envious, jealous. The mind which compares is the one which is possessed by a sense of inequality. So and so is high, another is low, etc. Somebody says, if somebody said, I can't understand it, I am dull, he would ask the question, how do you know you are dull? Or the opposite, how do you know you are intelligent? Only by comparing. And we compare according to our convenience. Annie Besant used to say that when a person is impatient with those he considers less intelligent, it gives him a sense of superiority. It boosts his ego. But that person rarely compares himself with those who are far superior to him in intelligence. The enlightened ones, the holy people of the earth, the brilliant scientists or whatever it is, there are so many people who are far more intelligent than us. But we compare ourselves only with those who are less intelligent and say, he is an idiot. So, what is that quality of mind which does not compare, which recognizes that each thing is itself, that everything has its own special nature. It will grow and develop according to that nature. This is all also theosophy. But he didn't talk theosophy in the conventional sense. But if we try to understand what he spoke, it was so theosophical. Perhaps he won't like my using the word, but a mind which doesn't compare is the mind of a yogi. In the Bhagavad Gita, there is a verse about the mind of a yogi looking alike on the Brahman, adorned with learning and humility, on the dog, which is often considered as an impure animal, at least by the Muslims, on the calf, which the Hindus consider as sacred, on the elephant and the outcast with an equal eye. The learned Brahman, spiritual and therefore humble and adorned with humility, the illiterate outcast considered by others as an outcast, the animal, whether sacred or polluted, to the yogi are all divine. If the mind doesn't compare, to it everything has the same value. So that single sentence, don't compare, is a sentence which everybody can understand, if they want to understand. It's not necessary to go into all the complications of a person's teaching. What is necessary is to go into the implications, all the underlying meanings, so to speak, through inquiry, through thoughtful questioning, pondering, never taking anything for granted. This was another thing that Krishnaji always insisted. Don't take your own thoughts, your conclusions, your beliefs, your viewpoints, apart from what anybody else says, for granted. Don't take it that I know this. The mind must never be in a state of knowing or having known. And then only it is in a state of learning. Now, all this was not preaching on his part, because one could see it in his life, in his relationships, and in his actions. I was witness to a very extraordinary visit he made. It was in 1975. I had to 1974, before the centenary convention, I was the general secretary of the Indian section. We had to organize the convention there in order to give the workers at Adyar the rest or the time they needed before preparing for the centenary convention. But I was obliged to go to Madras for a short visit just in the beginning of December, and found to my great delight that I would be on the same flight with Krishnaji. And we were passing through Calcutta from Benares, and we were told there was another friend with us, three of us were traveling together, that a certain person would come to the airport and take all of us to his home, a very large place with a big garden and all that, and that Krishnaji could rest there for 2 or 3 hours, have some lunch, and then take the flight to Madras. When we arrived at the airport, there was nobody there. We waited. After half an hour or so, I won't go into the details, the host turned up. We went to the house. It was about 1 o'clock. There was no sign of lunch. We waited and waited, and I felt rather worried. So I went to the hostess and I said, "Wouldn't you like to give lunch to Krishnaji so that he can rest before we go to the airport?" He was already in his 70s and frail. He was, you know, didn't appear to be physically a strong person. She said, "Oh no, my daughter will come back from school and she would have liked to have lunch with him." So we had to wait till the daughter came. And the lady was a compulsive talker. She talked without cessation all the time. And finally lunch appeared. And our friend who traveled with us and myself, we were getting a little impatient. They were told perhaps that Krishnaji started his meal with salad. And so in a small bowl, there were some lettuce leaves and other salad things, and this was put before Krishnaji. They didn't realize that this person wouldn't partake of anything which other people didn't have. So he took one lettuce leaf and passed it on. And the lady and the family talked. And after lunch, at least we hoped he would have half an hour's rest or so. No. She said she had to discuss her daughter's future with Krishnaji. So she cornered him, literally put him in a corner. And I don't know what she talked, but she talked till the last minute. But there was not a single sign of impatience, of irritation, of anything except gentleness, serenity, sympathy in Krishna. He was perfectly calm. And after all this happened, the question was asked, Krishnaji, where do you like to be most? You traveled so much, where do you like to be most? But it was obvious to us that the here meant something else. That the mind can be in a state where it doesn't compare the present condition with the past condition. Where it doesn't project another situation. Where it doesn't move away from the present. And therefore, it is content with the present. Again, you find this in the Bhagavad Gita or in some of the texts on yoga where it says that the yogi is one who is contented with whatever comes unasked. Of course, it's easy for us to be contented if we ask for something and we get it, but that's not it. Both pleasure and non-pleasure can come, they just come. But to learn to be contented by not comparing where you are with where you should be, wanting to be somewhere else, the mind is in a state of contentment. And one could see in him the test of a person who was speaking of what was true for him, not somebody who had theories and who was preaching. He was far from being a preacher. There are many occasions like this. There was another occasion when I went to meet him in the morning for no particular reason, just going there for the pleasure of his company. And it was breakfast time in Madras. And the table there, the dining table, could seat six people. And there were six of them at breakfast. Another lady came. Both of us entered the room. And they were all so busy talking that nobody bothered. And so we were looking around to see where we could sit down. And Krishnaji was the only one who got up, found a chair from somewhere and brought it. Because his mind was in a state of attention. He did observe many things which he didn't seem to observe. He spoke about observation, about listening, about learning, you know, all that indicate a certain the state of the mind which has not concluded that it knows. It is the state of the non-knowing mind, the innocent mind, the innocent but wise mind. And one could see it in him that he was in that state of attention and observation. But all this may make one imagine some kind of a remote, formidable individual. He wasn't that. He was very considerate, very, very gentle, affectionate, human in many ways, full of jokes at times, could enjoy himself, loved to go for walks, be with nature, wouldn't mind touching a very dirty child on the street if the child came to him. Yet he was very particular about cleanliness, about what he ate. He was a strict vegetarian. He never touched alcohol or not even coffee or anything, because he took great care about his body, its purity. But he could be very entertaining at times, very profound at other times. And therefore, being at lunch or breakfast or these informal occasions was a great pleasure and a privilege. Perhaps I can tell you of just two occasions. There was one occasion when spontaneously the conversation came to the subject of love. And then people said different things about it. And he said, "What is love?" And various answers were given, definitions were given. People tried to explain. He didn't answer, but he wasn't satisfied. And he again asked the question, "What is love?" Again somebody tried an answer. And he said, "You are spoiling it." Because, and in that way he silenced everybody. Because it was a spontaneous silence, not that he made them silent. But their remarks made everybody sort of sit up internally, because can one know the answer to the question, what is love, by giving an answer? Every answer you give, verbally or conceptually, is not the answer. In fact, you are spoiling it, because you deceive yourself into thinking that there is an answer. You know, he used that phrase, the impossible question. And the impossible questions are the most important questions. Dr. Algio this afternoon suggested that theosophy, what is theosophy, is an impossible question. Or rather, he put it the other way. Ancient wisdom is something which has to be known in a different way, realized, experienced. But when it is stated, then it's a different thing. So that was another one of the many conversations which were unforgettable. But there were also others. And I'll finish with one of the lighter ones. He had a fund of jokes. I am no good at remembering them. But I remember one that he told. He told Mrs. Gandhi, who was then the powerful Prime Minister of India, a joke which seemed to refer to her son in uncomplimentary terms. But Krishnaji never hesitated. I don't think he did it very gently till he made her laugh. But this one was not about that. This is about a man who went to the gate of heaven, and there was Saint Peter. And this man had lived a good life and enjoyed many things on this earth. So when he arrived there, Saint Peter said, "Better think over this very carefully. If you go in there and it's all very serious, you may find it terrible, boring, and you will regret having entered this gate. So the other place may be better." And the man hesitated. But Saint Peter said, "You can try it. If you don't like it, you come back here. I'll open the gate for you. So the man went down there and he was greeted by beautiful girls. He enjoyed their company. He was given nice food. He had a thoroughly good time. So after that he went back and told Saint Peter, "You are right. It's really a jolly place. And I don't think I want to sit on a cloud and play hymns to God on my harp. That doesn't sound interesting. So thank you very much for giving me good advice. I will go back there." And he went back, and instead of the pretty girls, ruffians greeted him, hit him right and left. He was thrown on the ground and treated ill, and he couldn't understand. And he said, "I came a little while ago and you were all so nice to me. What is the matter?" And they said, "Well, the last time you came as a tourist." Krishnaji enjoyed all that kind of thing. But in his later years, he felt very, very deeply the sorrow of the world, the growth of evil, the cruelty, the corruption. And he also used to say, "I could weep for you. You do not know what you have, what you are missing." I believe he said this even during the last days. "You do not know what you are missing." Because I believe his mind was open to some other sphere of splendor, this spiritual world of beauty, of joy, of light, and he felt a great sense of compassion for all those who couldn't know this. And I think it was for this that he labored so much, traveling tirelessly, giving long hours of his day to people to meet them, to explain over and over again, traveling, and although it was very hard for his body to put up with all the noise and the vibrations and all that, traveling incessantly, he did all that because he wanted to help. One can go on talking about him, but I'm not going to do that. But I will perhaps mention just one thing more, that it was not just through lectures, discussions, conversations that he conveyed something of what we needed to see, but sometimes through very startling questions. I remember one occasion when he asked me why I was doing whatever I was doing. And I said, in order to help. This was many years ago. And he said, in a challenging way, because he knew me well, he could speak freely, he said, "Who are you to help?" That was all. But if one thinks over it, as one always did when he put these questions, one really wonders, who am I to help? Do I know so much more? Do I know what the other person needs? Have I the wisdom to help? It brings a certain humility into one's mind. And these are the questions which he put, which we need to put to ourselves. He was only reminding us that we need to ask ourselves all these questions. Never take anything for granted. Let me not take for granted that I can help another, but ask myself, what does help mean? Am I in a position to do that? What is the best way of doing it? So that these questions, which he would sometimes ask casually, sometimes pose as a challenge, sometimes say in a way that people hardly noticed that a question was being put. He had all these different occasions, but these questions too helped to make one wake up a little bit more.